Streamline English Directions by Peter Viney. Published and copyright Oxford University Press, 1985. Cassette 1. Side 1. Unit 1. Learning Languages. Nazim Aziz.
I was only 7 when my family came here. I'd never been to school in Pakistan, and I suppose I started learning English straight away when I started school here. I never actually learned it. I was just chucked in with a lot of English kids. I reckon they thought I was really thick at first, but I didn't understand a word. Anyway, I just picked it up. It's weird because I haven't got a Pakistani accent. That's because I didn't learn English there. Some families use English at home in Pakistan and they'll never lose their accent. Everybody says I sound like a Liverpudlian because I went to school in Liverpool and I've always lived here.
Bernard Lefort.
I have studied English since 4 or 5 years in France. We studied at school and we learned the grammar and we translated everything into French. I started at the age of 12. I think I do not speak well. I am very slow. But I can understand everything I read very good, very well. I do not like to make mistakes, so I do not speak too much. I am living in Paris and I meet English people in my work. I have a very French accent, but this is not important. I am French and I am happy when people know this. Anyway, the English, I think French accents are very romantic, yes?
Luciana Rossi.
I am Italian. I was born in Rome. I studied English at school. I began to study at 13. All our lessons were in English. The teacher only translated some difficult words. I think I had a good basis at school, and then I went to England for the summer. At the beginning, everybody spoke very quickly, and I couldn't understand much, but after a few days, it was easier, and everything I had learned came back to me. I didn't go to a school in England, but I met my husband there. He's Scottish, and I thought his accent was very difficult at first. Now it's no problem. We live in Scotland.
Jesus Garcia.
I didn't study English at school in Mexico, and I started to learn at evening classes when I was 22. It was only 2 evenings a week, but I enjoyed the lessons. After 2 or 3 years, I went on holiday to the States and picked up a lot of expressions. Then I saved up and went to a language school in England for 2 months of 25 hours a week. There were all different nationalities in my class, and we had to speak English. Anyway, I reckon my English is okay now. I work in Mexico City, and I use English a lot in my job. I'm a travel agent.
Unit 2. Shark attack.
California lifeguard Casimir Pulaski was paddling with his surfboard in the Pacific Ocean off San Luis Obispo when a shark attacked him.
I had swum about 13 miles and I was about a mile and a half out when suddenly something came straight up out of the water, knocking me off my surfboard and into the air. I didn't know it was a shark until I surfaced again. Then I saw this big fish swimming around with my surfboard in its mouth. I could see its long gray dorsal fin, and I thought, oh my God, it's a great white shark. The next thought was, nobody gets this close to a great white and lives to tell the tale. You just don't know what you're going to do in a situation like mine. I saw the shark coming towards me with my surfboard in its jaws. I grabbed the tail of the surfboard and climbed back on it. I don't know why. Then I was afraid that if the shark let go of the board, he'd go for me. I got on my knees on the tail of the board, trying to keep my balance because all the time he's shaking the board, trying to get me off it. I was starting to fall back in the water where I'd be easy meat for him, so I moved up to the center of the board where I could hold onto the rail. But I slipped back 2 or 3 inches, and that's when I whacked him on the nose. I just open-handed slapped him on the nose. It was more an automatic reaction than a deliberate slap. It was like something was taking over my body. I was just 6 inches away from his teeth, but it was the eyes I remember most. It seemed as though he wasn't looking at anything when he was looking at me. Anyway, I just went for him and whacked him, and about 2 or 3 seconds after I hit him, he went. For a minute, I really thought I'd had it. I might have seen my life pass in front of me a little bit. And after he went, I started paddling back to the beach, but I was waiting for him to come back again. They were the worst moments. Then I kind of knew he wasn't coming back, and I managed to get to the beach. I stood up and looked at my hands and feet, practically counted my fingers and toes to make sure everything was intact. I couldn't believe I got away without a scratch. When I recovered my surfboard later, it had big teeth marks in it. A biologist who investigated said the bite mark was probably from a great white about 18 feet long. I had nightmares that night, but the next day I was back in the ocean. I love it. Even before the attack, I'd reckoned it was silly to worry about sharks because attacks are so rare. I still feel that.
Unit 3, the Yellow Bulldozer.
The house stood on a slight rise just on the edge of the village. It stood on its own and looked out over a broad spread of West Country farmland. Not a remarkable house by any means. It was about 30 years old, squattish, squarish, made of brick, and had 4 windows set in the front of a size and proportion which more or less exactly failed to please the eye. The only person for whom the house was in any way special was Arthur Dent, and that was only because it happened to be the one he lived in. On Wednesday night, it had rained very heavily. The lane was wet and muddy. But the Thursday morning sun was bright and clear as it shone on Arthur Dent's house for what was to be the last time. It hadn't properly registered yet with Arthur that the council wanted to knock it down and build a bypass instead. At 8 o'clock on Thursday morning, Arthur didn't feel very good. He woke up blearily, got up, wandered blearily round his room, opened a window, saw a bulldozer, found his slippers, and stomped off to the bathroom to wash. Toothpaste on the brush, so, scrub. Shaving mirror, pointing at the ceiling. He adjusted it. For a moment, it reflected a second bulldozer through the bathroom window. Properly adjusted, it reflected Arthur Dent's bristles. He shaved them off, washed, dried, and stomped off to the kitchen to find something pleasant to put in his mouth. Kettle, plug, fridge, milk, coffee, yawn. The word bulldozer wandered through his mind for a moment in search of something to connect with. The bulldozer outside the kitchen window was quite a big one. He stared at it. Yellow, he thought, and stomped off back to his bedroom to get dressed. Passing the bathroom, he stopped to drink a large glass of water and another. He began to suspect that he was hungover. Why was he hungover? Had he been drinking the night before? He supposed that he must have been. He caught a glint in the shaving mirror. Yellow, he thought, and stomped on to the bedroom. He stood and thought. The pub, he thought. Oh dear, the pub. He vaguely remembered being angry. Angry about something that seemed important. He'd been telling people about it. Telling people about it at great length, he rather suspected. His clearest visual recollection was of glazed looks on other people's faces. Something about a new bypass he'd just found out about. It had been in the pipeline for months, only no one seemed to have known about it. Ridiculous. He took a swig of water. It would sort itself out, he decided. No one wanted a bypass. The council didn't have a leg to stand on. It would sort itself out. God, what a terrible hangover it had earned him, though. He looked at himself in the wardrobe mirror. He stuck out his tongue. Yellow, he thought. The word yellow wandered through his mind in search of something to connect with. 15 seconds later, he was out of the house and lying in front of a big yellow bulldozer that was advancing up his garden path.
Unit 4. The Rumour. I'm afraid Mr. Joyce isn't here. He's gone to the hospital to see his grandmother.
Is Mr. Joyce here?
No, he's gone to the hospital.
Oh, he wanted me to wash his car. Did he leave the keys?
His car isn't here, I'm afraid. The police towed it away.
Did you hear that Mr. Joyce had gone to hospital?
No. What happened?
A car crash, I think. Anyway, the police have towed away the wreckage.
Oh, dear. I saw an ambulance on my way to work. Have you heard about Mr. Joyce? He was rushed to hospital by ambulance at 8:45 this morning. He had a serious car crash.
Perhaps we should send Mr. Joyce something.
How about some fruit? I saw some very nice strawberries this morning.
I was told that Joyce was allergic to strawberries.
Has anyone told you about Mr. Joyce?
No. What about him?
He crashed his car. It's a complete write-off. He's in hospital. Intensive care, I heard.
Ooh, are they going to operate?
Well, I'm not sure. I heard that he's got a lot of allergies.
Did you know about poor Mr. Joyce? He's in hospital after a terrible car crash, but they can't operate because he's allergic to antibiotics.
My sister was treated for her allergies by a Swiss specialist.
Do you know how Mr. Joyce is?
Oh, you've heard too. Bad news travels fast. I hear that he needs to see a Swiss specialist.
That's going to be expensive.
Yes, but there are 3,000 people working here. Let's have a collection to raise the money.
We're collecting for Mr. Joyce.
Who's he?
He works in the accounts department. He had an awful crash. They're flying a surgeon in from Geneva. He'll never work again.
Oh, dear. Well, here's a pound.
Hello, where is everyone?
I've got no idea, Mr. Joyce. How
was your grandmother?
Oh, she was fine. Wasn't a heart attack, just indigestion, that's all. I'd better go and collect my car from the police station. You know, I'd only parked on a double yellow line while I was getting her some flowers, and they towed it away.
Unit 6. The Explorer.
Good evening, and welcome to the Patrick Logan Show. On tonight's show, we're going to meet Broderick Foyle, the scientist who believes influenza comes from outer space. Moira Robinson, the author of Super Housewife. And we're going to hear the latest song from Shining Teeth. Our first guest needs little introduction from me. He's climbed Mount Everest, gone down the Amazon by canoe, and crossed the Sahara Desert on foot. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Richard Mills. Richard, welcome. You've been everywhere and you've done everything. And now your latest book has just been published, hasn't it?
That's right, Patrick. It's called Miles of Sand.
I've been reading it this week and there are some pretty fantastic stories in it.
They're all true, Patrick, all true.
I'm sure they are. I particularly like the story of your rescue. Could you tell us that one?
Yes. I was crossing the Sahara on foot when it happened. I had a small radio, but it packed up after 10 days or so, and I just kept on going. Obviously, when I didn't call in, people began to worry, and they sent out a search party. Now, I was travelling at night and sleeping during the day. On this particular morning, I had set up my tent and just crashed out. I'd been sleeping for a couple of hours when the search party arrived, and I didn't hear their truck. What happened was I woke up and heard these voices outside the tent. Someone said, "I had a look. He's dead, I reckon." "Who, me?" I shouted and popped my head out of the tent. You should have seen their faces. They were even more surprised when I refused a lift from them. But they did give me a new radio.
So what are you doing at the moment, Richard?
I'm keeping pretty busy. I'm writing a book about the Everest trip, and I'm preparing for my next expedition.
The next one? You mean there's somewhere you haven't been?
Oh, yes. I'm planning to walk across the polar ice cap via the North Pole.
You're going to walk?
That's right. I'm still looking for sponsors at the moment. It's going to be pretty expensive.
It sounds like a very ambitious project to me.
Yes, it is. The most difficult yet. You see, the temperature goes down to minus 75 degrees centigrade, and at that sort of temperature, metal freezes to the flesh. And, of course, I'll be walking across the sea on ice.
How are you preparing for that?
I train every day. I run 10 miles and do weight training. I shall have to be very fit indeed.
What sort of problems are you anticipating?
Well, first, there's navigation. Compasses don't work near the poles, so I'll be using satellite navigation throughout the trip.
Say you have equipment problems, like the radio in the Sahara.
I'll have a sextant to navigate by the stars, but it'll be plastic, of course.
Ah, yes. You said metal freezes to the flesh.
Yes.
How long will it take?
At the beginning, I'll be covering 10 miles a day. I won't be able to keep that up all the way, but I'll have reached the pole by mid-July. By then, I'll have been walking for 6 weeks, say 3 months for the whole journey.
One thing that interests me, you always have such wonderful photographs in your books. Will you be taking photos on this trip?
I'll be filming myself during the entire trip.
Oh, but how will you manage that?
I'll simply put the camera on a tripod.
And food? Will you be trying to shoot polar bears?
I certainly hope not. An aircraft will be dropping supplies to me at regular intervals. If the weather's good enough, that is.
Rather you than me, Richard. Can we look forward to a book about this trip?
I hope so.
Any ideas about a title? Miles of Snow, perhaps?
Actually, that's a possibility.
Thank you for talking to us, Richard. I hope you'll come back and tell us about the trip. And we'll be back after the break.
Unit 7. Describing a picture. 1.
Well, I really go for posters. I've got 5 or 6 in my room. Some of them are really cheap, 75p or something. The most I ever paid was £2.50, but that's not the point. If you get fed up with them, you can always change them. You can get all sorts of posters. There are the old adverts, or photos of rock stars, or just beautiful landscapes. I've got a photograph of a seagull flying over some waves with a slogan on it, "Everything is beautiful." Ones I like best, though, are the old Vogue magazine covers of the 1920s, I think. There's one marvellous one of a girl. She's very geometric, in a yellow kind of dress, against a lovely pale blue background. She's on an ocean liner, I suppose. 2.
Yes. We've got a picture. Horses. We bought it in Woolco. It's got a lovely frame. Kind of brown cloth with a strip of gold running round it. It was only about £30. I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. They say it's an original painting, but I reckon they do them on a production line. We just decorated the room and it matched the wallpaper. That sounds a bit odd, but why not? Anyway, I've always liked horses.
3.
I bought that years ago. It's by Van Gogh. It was pretty reasonable, really. About £7. And that included the block mounting. I know it's only a cheap reproduction, but I've always loved that painting. There was a reproduction at school. It's the colours, I suppose, and the texture. You can see the thickness of the paint, even if it's only a reproduction. Anyway, I'd rather have a cheap copy of a masterpiece than an original of something that's mediocre. 4.
We haven't really gone in for many pictures. You see, we've always been in rented flats, and it hasn't seemed worth it. Well, a calendar in the kitchen with views of Scotland, perhaps, and that collage of family photos. Maybe a poster over a damp patch on the wall. What I do buy, though, is books. Books of paintings. This is from a Beryl Cook book. Isn't it lovely? There's such a sense of humour, a kind of childlike quality that I really love.
5.
That's a screen print. It's a limited edition, actually. That means they print perhaps 100 and then destroy the plates. This particular one appealed to me very strongly. There's something so clean and simple about it. Photorealism. I love it. My husband says it does nothing for him. He thinks it's pretty awful, in fact. But then again, he hasn't got much taste. Not when it comes to art.
Unit 10. How do I get to...
1.
You pay over here, Mum.
All right, all right. Come on, keep together. 1 adult and 2 children, please.
190. Haven't you got anything smaller?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
190, 2, 3, 4, 5... And 5 is 10, and 10 is 20.
Thank you. Which way?
Just go through the door on your right. Follow the signs and you'll see everything.
Mum, I want a drink and a biscuit.
Me too, I'm starving.
Excuse me, is there a refreshment room?
It's just round the corner on the right.
I want to see the mummies first.
What?
The mummies, the Egyptian ones.
Yes?
We were particularly interested in seeing the mummies. Could you direct us to the Egyptian room?
It's the last room you come to.
Yes, but we'd like to go there first.
All right. Turn left when you get in. It's the first door you'll come to on the left.
Thank you. Sorry.
Two.
Excuse me.
Yes, love.
I think I'm a bit lost. I've been wandering around for ages, trying to find the tea.
The tea? Right, love. It's in the...
Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The 6th aisle along from here. Or is it the 7th? If you go this way, past the checkouts, you'll find it on the right.
I've been all around there.
It's just past the biscuits. On the middle shelf.
Oh, thank you very much, dear. I'm getting on a bit. I can't see as well as I could.
Oh, well. Come with me, love. I'll take you there.
3.
1 litre of whiskey, 200 Marlborough, 2 bottles of wine. Which currency are you paying in, sir?
Do you take Canadian dollars?
Oh, well, yes, sir, but I'll have to give you the change in Dutch guilders. Sterling or American dollars, I'm afraid.
Oh, dear. Yes, of course. And I've only got a $100 bill.
Are you in a hurry, sir?
Not particularly. Why?
Well, you could break your bill at the currency change desk and come back for your duty-free goods.
That's a good idea. Thanks. Where is it?
It's right in the middle of the concourse. Just turn left out of here and walk towards C and D piers. You'll see it straight in front of you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
4. Yes, madam. Can I help you?
I've got a connecting flight to London. BA, let me just find my ticket. Yes, it's BA208.
Right. Is your luggage checked through?
Yes, it is.
It leaves at 14:30 from gate 27 on Pier B. Smoking or non-smoking?
Non-smoking. I prefer an aisle seat if you've got one.
Yes, that's fine. Seat 5D.
Ah. Is there somewhere to get a coffee?
Of course. Right over in that corner, between B Pier and A Pier. Can you see it?
Yes. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Yes, sir. Can I help you?
5.
Excuse me, miss?
Yes, madam?
I can't find the pet food. I expect I've just walked past it or something. Can you tell me where it is?
Pet food. Oh, it's opposite the frozen meat cabinet.
The frozen meat? Where's that exactly?
It's near the back. Look, just go towards the back of the shop, and it's the... Let me think. The 2nd aisle in from the right-hand side. The pet food's about 3/4 of the way along, on your right.
Thank you so much.
6.
Excuse me.
Yes, miss.
I particularly wanted to see the Victorian room, but I seem to have missed it.
It's in the far corner, miss. Just go out of that door and turn right. Walk through the main hall and you'll see 2 doors in front of you. Go in the left-hand one. That's the Roman room.
Ah, I've been in there already.
Yes, you must have come out of the wrong door. Anyway, once you're in the Roman room, take the door on the left. That's the Victorian room.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Unit 11. Raging Inferno.
I'm sitting out on the road in front of my own house where I've lived for 13 or 14 years. It's going down in front of me. The roof is falling in. It's in flames, and there's nothing I can do about it. And the flames are in the roof. And God damn it, it's just beyond belief. My own house, and everything around is black. There are fires burning all around me.
Unit 13. The Language of Advertising. A.
Hello there. My name's Steve Newman, but I expect you know that. I have to entertain a lot. That's one of the problems of living in Beverly Hills. And after dinner, I always give my guests Max Caffeine Instant Coffee.
Steve, this coffee's marvelous. It's so fresh. Where do you get it?
Glad you like it, Raquel. It's my secret.
B.
I'm standing in a laundrette in Bromley, Kent. It's Monday morning, and I've just asked 10 housewives to do half their wash in Fizz detergent with its new XR74 foam booster, and half in another leading brand. Well, all of them agreed that Fizz with new XR74 washed whiter, cleaner, and fresher. Fizz with XR74.
For families, use Fizz. For families, use Fizz.
C.
A country walk, a summer's day, the man you love, somewhere to sit, the sky is blue, your love is new. Make him happy with a Macbeth cigar. Macbeth, with the masculine aroma of carefully selected tobaccos.
D.
Mom, I'm so bored. Do I have to stay in bed?
Yes, dear. You've been ill.
Sick children are always a problem. Help to give them energy and vitality again with Glucozone, the sparkling health drink with added vitamins and minerals.
E.
Did you enjoy your meal, sir?
Thank you. May I have the bill?
Here you are, sir.
I see. Do you take credit cards?
Well, sir, that depends. Which card is it?
It's an International Streamline Platinum card.
Oh, in that case, of course we do. Thank you very much, sir. And madam, do come again.
F.
Are you looking for a car that's prettier than a Polo, faster than a Ford, mightier than a Maestro, cheaper to run than a Renault? Then you're looking for the new BM Calypso. Phone your local dealer for a test drive, and if you buy a Calypso this month, he'll give you a free radio, a full tank of petrol, 1 year's road tax, and free number plates.
G.
All right, I went up the pub last night. They didn't have my favourite beer. Run out, they said. Have some of this Burgermaster lager, they said. What I said? Lager? Not for me. Go on, try some, they said. Well, I had a glass. Didn't think much of it, but I had another. Load of rubbish, I said. Try another, they said. I did. Awful, I said. I don't believe it, they said. Try another. This is the worst beer I've ever had, I said. Try another, we'll pay, they said. Now it's rubbish, I said, and staggered off into the night. I was laughing. 5 free glasses of Burgermaster, and it's not that bad.
H.
Don't forget, Johnson's January sale starts Monday the 28th December in Johnson's stores in Bournemouth, Southampton, Portsmouth, Brighton and Canterbury. Johnson's January sale, 9 o'clock on the 28th.
I.
I want to talk to you tonight about a very personal problem. Foot odor. Do you suffer from smelly feet? I did, until I discovered Malcolm's talcum powder. Now I don't walk around smelling like a piece of old cheese. Remember, for talcum, say, Malcolm. For talcum, say,
Malcolm!
J.
Hi, Sandy. I love your hair.
I've just washed it.
Mine is always so dry and unmanageable. Yours looks so clean and natural.
That's because I use Aerial conditioner. It's naturally balanced for dry hair. It's been tested for years, and it's safe enough even for a child.
I'll try some. Can I borrow yours?
Buy some. You'll be surprised. It's the cheapest on the market.
Unit 15. Britain from the air.
Salisbury.
Salisbury was one of the earliest new towns. The city was founded in 1220 to replace the town of Old Sarum, 3 miles to the north. Old Sarum had been founded by the Romans and developed by the Saxons, and was already an important town in the 11th and 12th centuries. The water supply was poor, though, and so the town was moved to its present site, where smaller rivers join the River Avon. The most striking feature is the cathedral, which was founded at the same time as the town. It was built between 1220 and 1258, and is thought to be one of the most beautiful in Europe. The spire is 404 feet high, making it the tallest church in Britain, and was added in 1334. The cathedral is 473 feet long. Salisbury is a market town for the surrounding agricultural area, and a shopping centre for the large numbers of military bases to the north of the city, on Salisbury Plain. It's also a tourist centre, because of the cathedral and old town, and because of Stonehenge, which is 10 miles north-northwest of the city. It's situated in central southern England, about 30 miles inland from the south coast, and 83 miles west of London. The city centre is particularly pleasant, as a ring road takes heavy traffic away to the east.
Carnarvon.
Carnarvon is the usual spelling, that is, C-A-E-R-N-A-R-F-O-N, nowadays, although older maps use the English spelling, C-A-E-R-N-A-R-V-O-N. As it's the centre of the area of Gwynedd, which is 75% Welsh-speaking, the Welsh spelling is preferred. Gwynedd, by the way, is G-W-Y-N-E-D-D. It's situated in North Wales and has always been an important strategic and military site. The Romans built a castle here in A.D. 78. The present castle was started by King Edward I in 1283 and completed in 1322. His son was born here in 1284 and became the first Prince of Wales. Prince Charles was invested as Prince of Wales at the castle on July the 1st, 1969. The castle at the top left is one of the finest surviving castles in Britain. The old town wall is still in good condition. The population is 10,500, and the town is a market centre and a tourism centre for the Snowdonia National Park. There is no railway, the nearest station being at Bangor, 9 miles away. It's famous for sailing and fishing. Sea and river fishing are both excellent, which adds to the town's attractions. Durham.
Durham, in County Durham, is in the northeast of England, about 14 miles from Newcastle and 260 miles from London. It is built on a bend in the River Weir, and it grew around the Norman Castle, which was built in 1072 to protect England from the Scots. A wall blocked off the peninsula. The cathedral was begun in 1093 and has been called the finest Norman building in Britain, if not in Europe. The religious schools developed from the 15th century onwards, eventually becoming the University of Durham in 1832. It is England's third oldest university, after Oxford and Cambridge. Durham is an administration and market centre, and although it is surrounded by coal mining villages, it has remained reasonably quiet and beautiful. The present population is 24,777.
Liverpool.
Liverpool is one of Britain's largest cities. The city population is 605,600, but the population of the Merseyside conurbation is more than 1.25 million. Its most famous inhabitants are probably John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Ringo Starr, and Liverpool has built a £1 million Beatles museum. Its fame in the world of football is as widespread as its fame in pop music, with Liverpool Football Club being the most successful European team of the late 70s and early 80s, winning the European Cup 3 times. However, there's a lot more to Liverpool than just music and football. It developed very quickly in the 18th and 19th century as Britain's major Atlantic port. It was a centre for the cotton trade and manufacturing industry, as well as a centre for ships taking part in the infamous slave trade. At one time, there were 7 miles of continuous docks along the River Mersey. The river is crossed by 2 tunnels, a railway tunnel built in 1886 and a road tunnel, the Mersey Tunnel, in 1934. For many years, ferries were the main way across the river, which has no bridges at this point. There are also 2 20th-century cathedrals, one Church of England, the other Roman Catholic. The Catholic cathedral, one of the few in the world built with an underground car park, can be seen in the lower right foreground of the picture. The famous Lime Street station can be seen just right of the centre. Liverpool is a cosmopolitan city, and to the anger of both the Irish and the Welsh, it has been called the real capital of Ireland and the real capital of Wales because of the large number of Liverpudlians of Irish and Welsh descent. Today, it is well known for the wit and humour of its people and its high unemployment figures. There are plans to attract tourism to the area and to the northwest generally by converting areas of dockland into leisure areas, parks and museums.
Unit 16. The Town That Is Going to Die.
You can take either the Kedawi route or the Clonevy road. Kedawi's the better road, but the Clonevy way's shorter. It's up to you, really. I'll tell you the short way anyway. Go about 2 miles up this road until you get to Clonevy. Just after you leave Clonevy, you'll see a turning on the left. The B4007. Keep going along here for about 2 miles or so, past the Tredawi mine on your left. Go down the hill into the town and you'll come to a roundabout. Turn left, past the post office, and go on to the next junction. You'll see a church on the other side of the road. Bear right and carry on to the next fork in the road. Take the right fork and look out for a little road, it's a track really, on the right. It's easy to miss it. Go 100 yards or so up the track and look at the field to your left. That's the site for the reactor.